central bank digital currencies, digital IDs, artificial intelligence, and big tech surveillance. What does our digital future really look like? Join me, Alastair Harding, for a look into our digital future every Wednesday on Paul Brennan's Breakfast Show, right here on Reality Check Radio. Welcome to another edition of Our Digital Future on Reality Check Radio. My name is Alastair Harding, and over the past few weeks, we've been diving into the subjects of CBDCs, that's central bank digital currencies, and digital IDs. And so today, we're going to pull back a little bit and look at the bigger picture. Where's all this leading us? How can we live inside and or outside of it? And what are the politics behind this sudden hurry to digitize everything? Or has this been building a lot longer than we all realize? And furthermore, we're also going to talk about something new, the digitization or the tokenization of our assets. And to do that, I have with me author Aaron Day, who you will hear very shortly tell us that the world ahead of us is one where there is one global platform where everybody's assets will be digitized and tied to digital IDs and digital money that can be programmed and controlled centrally. It's a scary interview, I admit, but also if you stay to the end, you'll also hear the way out that he envisages, which is not as hard as one might think. In fact, it's as easy as simply walking away, which is something that many of us have been practicing in recent years. Aaron Day is also an entrepreneur, investor, and advisor, with a background spanning nearly three decades in the sectors of e-commerce, healthcare, blockchain, AI, and also clean technology. He's also an author who's written a book titled The Final Countdown, which outlines the coming CBDC era and how to survive it by using strategies of divesting from fiat currencies and embracing cryptocurrencies as well as gold and silver. And what's more, he also once stood for President of the United States to draw attention to these issues that we're talking about today. And lastly, he's also a fellow at the Brownstone Institute and chairman and CEO of the Daylight Freedom Foundation. So welcome to Our Digital Future, Aaron Day.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we've been doing this series called Our Digital Future, talking about digital money, digital IDs, digital assets, all of that. It just seems, after talking about it so much, that there's a sort of inevitability about all of this. Is it avoidable?
I think it's absolutely avoidable. I mean, we have free will. So we certainly have the ability to change our actions and to change the direction. But what we have to recognize is that this plan towards digitalization and kind of the consolidation of power through government and the consolidation of our assets digitally is something that's been in the works for about five decades. So we have to recognize that we're kind of in the late stages here, but it can be stopped through our direct action and non-compliance.
You say five decades. Could you take us back to where this all began?
Well, I'll say it actually goes back even further than five decades. It goes back to the beginning of what's called the technocracy movement. And technocracy is a movement where basically the idea is to reorganize society, where elites pick scientists and engineers to make all of our decisions for us. And the philosophy behind this is that, you know, humans are going to basically destroy themselves. But if we properly apply technology to the human condition, we might be able to save everyone. And the only way to do that is by picking the best scientists and engineers. That's the best case. That's painting the best case scenario from their perspective. And so there was a group called Technocracy, Inc. that was formed in the United States in the 1930s that actually met. And it still exists today, but it was like it was a cult. They basically would dress in gray suits. At one point, General Motors even made a car color called Technocracy Gray, and they would push these ideas. And their idea was, the big idea, if I had to sum it up into one part, was to flip the entire economy from being a price-based economy to being an energy credit-based economy. So this is an idea, this idea of a system running on energy credits started in the 1930s. So there was some infighting with the group and it died down. It didn't completely die, but it kind of slowed in its momentum. And then it was picked back up, these ideas, in 1971, 1972, with the formation of an organization called the Trilateral Commission, which was started by Rockefeller and Brzezinski. And their whole idea was, this really kicked off this entire movement towards globalization and technocracy. And so the Trilateral Commission literally created a blueprint called the New International Economic Order, which they pushed through the UN the following year, 73. And that has become the basis, if you actually track it all the way back, of UN Agenda 2030 and the 17 Sustainable Development Goals. So that's what I mean by these ideas are the ideas are more than 50 years old, but the actual attempt to practically implement them started with the Trilateral Commission in the early 1970s.
Okay, so you touch on the Trilateral Commission there. Is that the answer to the who are they who are doing all of this question?
Well, the who is they question is actually answerable. I mean, there are a lot of levels to this, and there are certainly a lot of conspiracies and how deep do you want to go. But from what I've traced back, and I actually talk about this in my book, there are really, you know, four groups that are kind of the behind the scenes shadow groups. There's the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg Group, and the Club of Rome. Those are really the four groups. And when you dig into those, there's an interesting guy named Patrick Wood, who's written a lot on technocracy and transhumanism. And he's been following the Trilateral Commission now for four or five decades. I mean, this guy has been building a database. They don't publish who their members are. The Trilateral Commission does not make that available, but he's actually been researching it for over four decades, and he kept a list. So he sent me a list of who the Trilateral Commission members are. There are 400 to 500 members at any one time in the group, and it's half of the people are from industry, and then you've got, you know, whatever, some 25% are from academia, and then it's split between people in the media and in government positions. And so these are kind of the elite. And there's a huge overlap between amongst these different groups, amongst the Trilateral Commission and the Club of Rome and Council on Foreign Relations in Bilderberg, you will see overlap. And I've been doing a lot of research looking at the interconnections, but those are really the guys that are behind the scenes kind of pushing this. And if you had to say, well, what is their motivation? I mean, you know, do they really believe what they're saying? I mean, there's part of this that says, hey, they really believe they're saving the world by doing this, which they're wrong, even if, you know, their intentions are good. But in any event, what they're creating is a system that they ultimately will benefit and control all of the resources under, because by creating the system based on energy credits, they are also at the same time behind the scenes buying up land, buying up forests so that they can, you know, monetize the carbon credits. And they're pushing all of the agendas so that, you know, only World Economic Forum partner companies can afford to comply with and benefit from these onerous environmental standards and legislation. So it's really a gigantic power grab for these elite multinational corporations.
We started doing this series about CBDCs in our digital future, mainly because our central bank here in New Zealand, it's called the Reserve Bank, they've announced that they're developing a CBDC for deployment by or around 2030. And so we've spoken a lot on that subject, and I've done a lot of research to understand the topic. And as part of that research, I read up a lot on Richard Werner, the famous economist who came up with quantitative easing, because like you, he can see the dystopian nature of a CBDC or a system of CBDCs. And in one lecture, he said it very simply. He said, all you need to know is the C in CBDC, because that stands for central, as in centralized monetary policy, as in Soviet-style monetary control. Is that what we're looking at, a modern form of communism?
I mean, you could argue that, you know, technocracy and communism share a lot of traits in common. Again, if you look at it at the end, it's there aren't any property rights, there aren't any individual rights. This is a worldview that says only scientists and engineers are qualified to make decisions for people. So if you want to know what the technocracy looks like in the end game, there's one global currency, and that currency is backed by energy credits. So it's based on entirely how much energy you use within a closed system. And the elements of a social credit score are the 17 Sustainable Development Goals that you see from the United Nations, which covers literally everything from poverty to healthcare to where you live, the regulation of the land, the air, the sea. All 17 of those UN Sustainable Development Goals you could plug in as being elements of a social credit system, and where they're tracking your behavior and punishing and rewarding you based on those 17 goals and how they relate to your energy usage. So that is what the end goal of this looks like. One interesting example to kind of back this up further, you may not be aware, there is a United Nations branded MasterCard from a company called Doconomy, where people actually sign up for this today. Your audience can go and Google Doconomy MasterCard. It is a MasterCard that has the UN logo on it. It has a 13 with a symbol around it representing the Climate Action Sustainable Development Goal. And this card shuts off if you use too much carbon. MasterCard already has relationships with 136 companies where they are already tracking your carbon usage and tying that to your financial transactions. So this infrastructure has been built over the last, you know, probably 10 years. And it's going on right under our noses. But it is a consolidation of power. You could look at it as communism. I look at it more as I'd label it technocracy. But the idea and the reason I've focused on central bank digital currencies, this is my number one focus. I dropped everything that I was doing in life to basically warn people about CBDCs and to educate them on how to stop using fiat currency and to start using alternatives like crypto, gold, and silver for day-to-day transactions, because that's actually how you stop CBDCs. But if you actually look at the research and what's going on with CBDCs, there are 134 countries representing 98% of the global GDP currently working on developing CBDCs. That was 134. 4 years ago, it was 35. 11 countries have already implemented CBDCs. You said New Zealand by 2030. I bet they'll do it before then because the technological development is so much further along than we realize. And that's actually what frightened me about what I learned about the United States, which is that the US has been working on a CBDC since 2015. And they really started going at it aggressively in 2019. They've already developed the technology. So the technology is basically sitting there waiting for a crisis to bring it in, just like we got all of the surveillance state and everything that came in under the COVID tyranny. So it is absolutely about control. They will try to market and say it's about financial inclusion, but it's anything but financial inclusion. You need permission to use CBDCs. CBDCs can be tracked, they can be programmed. They will tell you what you can and cannot buy and when you can and cannot buy it. And they will tie that to a social credit system. And so there really aren't any positive elements to this. Nobody benefits from, there's no end user or citizen that benefits from the implementation of a CBDC. It is entirely intended to be a control system. But I will add before that, most of what people worry about when they hear about CBDCs being tracked, having your financial transactions censored, losing access to your bank account, that already happens today. I know it happens in the US, and I'm going to assume it happens in New Zealand too. In the US, I actually did an analysis of the terms and conditions of the four largest banks. And in their own contract, it says we can cancel your account without cause, we can change the fees without notice. We can, and by the way, they do, sell or give away your transaction data to third parties. So in the United States now, banks are giving your transaction files to the IRS, and now they're using AI to figure out whether or not you have paid enough taxes. And then the final catch-all is they reserve the right to change the terms and conditions without your consent. So they can basically do whatever they want with the money in your bank account anyway. So as I say to people, the money you have in the bank account is not yours. It literally does not belong to you. And unbeknownst to us, we signed away. When we signed up for our bank account, we signed a contract. Or increasingly, whether we sign up for a new technology service or a social media account, we do these click wrap agreements where we click, yes, I consent to the terms and conditions, not realizing there's 40 to 50 pages of legal documents behind that where we've given away our data and given away, you know, our right to even complain about being mistreated.
My next question was going to be about your book, The Final Countdown. And I was going to ask you, okay, so what does it look like? How do they actually get us into this position where we don't have any choice? It sounds to me like what you just said there is that we're already there.
We're already largely there, right? We're already largely trained to use digital transactions. Most people don't use cash. They've been phasing out ATMs. They've been making it harder for us to take our money out of the bank anyway. They've been moving towards digitalization. So the overwhelming majority of transactions are already digital. So it's not much of a behavior change. In fact, what really happens behind the scenes, and this is something that people, you know, I know people that I know that are pro-liberty minded in the United States have a big misconception around this. What they say is, well, you know, the government's incompetent. They'll never be able to roll something out like this. And then they'll say, and by the way, banks won't want this because it will put them out of business because people will now have accounts with the central bank instead of with the bank. And the truth is that the people that are building the CBDCs are not the government themselves. It's the banks funding the best development talent in the world. That's actually who's funding and building the CBDCs. The only role of government is to pass a bill that bankers have actually drafted that they probably won't even read to put it into effect. So don't have any complacency about whether or not the technology will work. The technology will work, and it does work. It just doesn't do what we would want it to do from a privacy perspective. The second is they've already rolled out 11 CBDCs, and including in China, they've done a partial rollout as well. There isn't a replacement of the banks with the central bank. It works the same way the current system works, which is the central bank will issue CBDCs to the individual banks, and then the individual banks will continue to do the functions that they do today, issue credit cards, bank accounts, mortgages, and the like. The difference is you'll now have this complete programmable surveillance system built into it. So there's no disincentive here for the banks.
We're going through a lot of change at the moment, and in US politics, it's most obvious. Will any of this change with, say, for instance, if Donald Trump was to get back into power?
No. And I will say, I did run for president. I've been close to the political process for 30 years. My stepmother was actually the co-chair of the Republican National Committee from 2012 to 2016. She was Donald Trump's ambassador to Costa Rica. I have seen the United States political process close up. In New Hampshire, through my political activities, I've run PACs, I've run organizations to help get over 100 candidates elected, and I've run for U.S. Senate, and I've run for president myself. And I will tell you, there is no way that we vote ourselves out. We are at a phase now where the way that we stop CBDCs is non-compliance. And I could go into this in great detail. In fact, I don't know how familiar your audience is with what's going on with U.S. politics, but Vivek Ramaswamy was one of the Republican presidential candidates. He read my book. I had three conversations with him about it. I hounded him on the CBDC issue. I'm in New Hampshire, which is the most important state for the primary, and he pushed Trump to come out against CBDCs the night before the New Hampshire primary, knowing that New Hampshire, and from our conversations, that could be an issue that would sway voters here. So that's why Trump came out, in part. I'm not going to say that's the sole reason, but that was at least part of the reason why Trump came out on it. However, when you look at what he said, there are several different ways that you can get at effectively having a CBDC. So, for instance, you could say, which Republicans in the United States have put forward legislation that would make it so that only banks could issue stablecoins, giving them exclusivity on stablecoins. And so a stablecoin could be a CBDC. A stablecoin is programmable digital money that would be issued by banks. So it would be issued by the banks instead of the central bank. So therefore, Trump could come out and say, I will never allow a CBDC, but he could allow stable coins through the banking system. And from our perspective as citizens, it's the exact same thing as a CBDC. And that is what they're actually doing. When you read the legislation that has actually passed the House, it won't pass the Senate, but that the Republicans have actually pushed, it's all been around giving banks more control, putting more information and reporting requirements on the consumers, trying to ban privacy coins. This is the focus of the Republican side of this. So if that's what the Republicans are doing, so in the United States, based on our political dynamic, you would think that the best shot against stopping CBDCs would be the Republicans, and their actual legislation is doing everything to make CBDCs easy to implement in one of a variety of different ways.
There's another aspect that I want to talk about that we haven't really touched on yet, and so it may be new to our listeners on this topic, and that's the topic of tokenization. We're hearing that word more and more in relation to the digitization of everything. Can you tell us, what is it? Can you explain it to us?
Sure. Tokenization may be a bigger concept, opportunity, and threat even than central bank digital currencies themselves, and they're actually linked together. And I can explain especially from the U.S. perspective, and I'll dig into more on the New Zealand side. But before I do that, I want to mention a concept that in the United States called the Great Taking. And there's a book by a gentleman named David Rogers Webb. You can actually get his book for free. He's written this book, made it available in PDF form. He's a very successful investment banker with a career on Wall Street, and he uncovered after the financial collapse in 2008 some disturbing findings regarding legal changes that had been made in all 50 states regarding your ownership of your stocks in publicly traded companies. And without going into a lot of the details, the basis of it is this. Right now in America, people don't actually really own the shares that they have in publicly traded companies or in their retirement accounts through 401ks. They think they own it. But when you are a shareholder in a company, you get to vote. This is a fundamental part of being a shareholder in a company. Well, already today, if you own a 401k, a 401k is just basically a collection of stocks that you invest in. You don't get to vote those shares. Those shares, the voting of those shares is turned over to whoever is managing that 401k. So it could be BlackRock or it could be Fidelity. So this is why sometimes you'll hear people say BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, they own everything. They own all of these public companies. Mm. You may even see some of these memes from time to time. Well, in reality, it's not that they own those stocks. It's that you have accounts with them where you're buying 401ks through them. And they're the ones that are actually technically owning the stock, and they're the ones that are voting it. But it's your money that is actually giving them the power to vote these shares. So it's actually even worse than – it's kind of worse than them owning it, because they get all of the control without putting up any of the money. Now, these changes, these changes that were made to the law after the 2008 financial crisis make it so that if there's a financial collapse – the person that ends, so let's say Fidelity goes under. Well, you might think, well, I've got my 401k. I have all these stocks with Fidelity. If Fidelity goes out of business, well, I own my stocks, right? Fidelity's just providing a service. No, it turns out based on these changes in law, the secured creditor, whoever has lent money to Fidelity and has what's called a secured position, securitized by your stock ownership, those people are the ones that end up with your stocks and your assets in a financial collapse. This is why it's called the Great Taking, because while there is insurance for investments, like you're insured up to a certain amount, it's a fraction of a fraction of a percent. So if there's an actual collapse, you'll get pennies on the dollar back, and then all of the rest of your assets will go to the secured creditors who are the largest banks in America.
This is the you'll own nothing part of the you'll own nothing and be happy.
That's exactly what this is. And so what tokenization is about is when you tokenize something, you create a digital representation of it. And typically you put it on a blockchain, which could be good or bad, depending upon the blockchain and what the terms are. One of the benefits of blockchain technology. I'll take a step back. Today, almost everything that you buy and sell is stored in a database. When you buy or sell something, somewhere somebody is keeping track of that, and they're moving around this quantity move here. If you buy a house, you have a title, and that title, the information about the title is stored in a database. The same is true with a car, stocks, bonds, everything that we trade is usually in a centralized database. The problem with centralized databases are they can be hacked, which I think you're probably seeing that in New Zealand. I think we're seeing that everywhere. Everybody is getting hacked all of the time, including governments. But also because it's centralized, the companies involved themselves can engage in fraudulent behavior, which happens often as well. So part of the idea behind blockchain technology was, well, we'll create, instead of having a centralized database, we'll make this a decentralized database where everybody gets a copy of the database and where you can't delete the database. So the idea here is that this would provide transparency and would get rid of fraud. And so this is what people were excited about with the underlying technology of Bitcoin. Unfortunately, what they're building with CBDCs are not this publicly open, transparent version where everybody can see all of the transactions. What you're getting is something that is centrally controlled and can be monitored and censored and programmed by third parties. what they're doing right now is they're going to take stocks and bonds, create tokens representing those stocks and bonds, and put those on one common ledger tracked with CBDCs. And I'm not saying this is in a theoretical sense. In the United States, our retail CBDC project is called Project Hamilton. It is a project that was worked on between MIT, the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and then there's something called Regulated Liability Network, which is what I've just been describing. It's this platform where you have to tokenize your assets, you have to register. This is where the digital ID comes in. You have to go through a know your customer process, anti-money laundering process, so that now all of your assets are digitized, they're put into this database, tracked to your ID, linked to CBDCs. This is called Regulated Liability Network, and it is a pilot between the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, MIT, the Bank for International Settlements, DTCC, five of the largest banks in New York. But here's a kicker. This combined, I've spoken to a developer at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York who says that when they roll out CBDCs, they will roll it out alongside Regulated Liability Network. So we are going to get digital money and digital assets at the same time. Furthermore, other countries are developing regulated liability networks as well. The UK is working on one, Europe is working on one, Japan is working on one, and they have developed the technology standards so that the regulated liability networks can communicate with one another. What does this mean? This means there will be one global platform where everybody's assets will be digitized, tied to digital cash, and that can be programmed and controlled centrally. One digital global platform.
To give us a better picture of that, what does that mean, for example, if they put your car into this digital asset register? This is digitization. So how does that affect you in the real world?
Well, they can control your car. I mean, just like right now, you have to register your car, you have to get insurance for your car. I mean, in the future, they can make it so that, oh, I want to go sell my car. Okay, well, so right now, if you sell your car, you have a title, you give the title to someone. Well, now in the future, the only way you're going to be able to sell that car is through this digital system. Well, if your social credit score isn't good, if you've spoken out against the government, or if you refuse to get your vaccine, and now you want to sell your car, they can say, no, we're blocking your ability to trade your token version of your car to transfer that ownership to somebody else. Literally, we're talking about not just controlling money, the ability for all of your assets to be able to be centrally controlled.
Mm. And I noticed, to give this some New Zealand context, I suppose, that all the tools and the structure of this is being put in place without any real meaningful debate. The CBDC story is only being talked about on a very superficial level in our news media. Same with the digital ID laws. And just yesterday, I also noticed a similar superficial comment story on the work being done about the digitization of our assets. But it's not just here, is it? It's all over the world. This is like COVID all again. The preparation is all happening in lockstep. The pieces are all being put in place. But what's the event that will bring all these pieces that are being put in place? What's the event that brings them all into play?
I think we know enough now to know that the method by which all of these things get implemented, it's problem, reaction, solution. Either create a problem or manufacture a problem, generate a reaction, which is fear, is the primary one, and then deliver the solution that you've already created to the problem that you created when people were in a fearful state where they have no other choice. And I will say, the reason that I put so much urgency on writing the book and dropping what I'm doing and going around the country and talking to people about this and trying to get this word out is that emergency, it could happen literally at any point in time, because at least in the United States, there are several ways that this could happen. If there's terrorism, if there is some kind of war situation in the Middle East or abroad where there are claims of money laundering, financing either side of the conflict, right? So basically what Congress will do is they'll say, well, we have to keep people safe. We have to get rid of cash and we have to get rid of cryptocurrencies, or otherwise money laundering and terrorism will flourish and people will die. That's the easiest one, and that's simple to happen. In the U.S., we had the Patriot Act, which was passed 45 days after 9/11, which just stripped Americans of rights, and it added the TSA and all the airport screening and everything else. We got the TARP bill that bailed out all the banks in 2008 in an emergency. We got the $2.2 trillion CARES Act for COVID, which did all kinds of things, including removing banks' requirement to have reserves and added a whole bunch of surveillance and money for contract tracing. That $2.2 trillion bill passed 16 days after COVID was declared a pandemic on a voice vote. They didn't even record who voted for it. So when people say to me, well, it'll never pass here, in an emergency, both sides will pass it. In the U.S., they'll use the right, the Republicans could use immigration as a justification for it. Well, we have all of these illegal immigrants coming across the border. They're not paying taxes. So we need digital ID and we need digital currency. And so because whereas normally you would think the Republicans are the ones that are anti-CBDC, they won't be in this emergency because you can see how both sides would come together. I don't see any scenario where this is rolled out piecemeal or using incentives. This will be rolled out in a take it or leave it sense. Which is why what my focus has been on is building and educating people about alternatives so that you can get out now, because it's your current fiat currency. It's the dollar that is the, it's already tyrannical, but it's going to become even worse once they implement CBDC. So if you manage to move outside of that system and start to engage in trade, not using your current currency, then when they go to try to force you to have a CBDC, you're like, well, you know what? No, thanks. I'm all set. And now you've created your own alternate economy and you're trading with people and you're still able to go about your business without this complete digital tyranny being thrust upon you.
Okay, so you've written a book, The Final Countdown, and that talks about getting yourself ready for this digital future. And you also do lectures on how to live outside this dystopian system. How do we do that? How do we live outside the system?
I'll give you a little bit of a quick backstory on my history so that it explains how and why I got into this. So I started my first tech company in 1995. I sold it, became an investor for a while. Then I started a healthcare company in 2008, which was successful, but it was destroyed by Obamacare, Dodd-Frank, and the Department of Justice. I wasn't specifically targeted. Nobody went after my company. I was just collateral damage from bad policy. That made me a political activist. That's what got me into the political stuff. I thought, well, you know, maybe at the federal level or even the state level, we could make change. I won't go through all the details about how I got there, but it's numerous and it could be a separate series. I determined that politics isn't the way out. So I exited fiat currency and started focusing all of my attention, not just on crypto. When I say crypto, it's not, oh, I'm going to, you know, buy crypto and sit on it, and that's my strategy. My whole interest in 2019 when I exited the dollar was to focus actually on tokenization. So how can we use this technology? So the same technology behind Bitcoin that allowed you to use money without a third party, that separated money and state, apply that same concept to get rid of third parties involved in other transactions, whether that's stocks, bonds, real estate, art, whatever it is. Here's an opportunity to apply this technology in a way that promotes freedom and decentralization, that gets rid of corruption and third parties that take a cut and government control. That was basically my motivation for this. And so being in New Hampshire, I had a bit of an advantage because New Hampshire, at least at one point, it maybe still is, has the highest usage of crypto per capita of any place in the world. I mean, there are stores and restaurants that have been taking crypto here since 2012. So there are some places where I can go and actually buy things directly with cryptocurrency. In other cases, living on crypto involves using crypto to buy gift cards, or using crypto to buy debit cards to make transactions, which it is living off crypto in the sense that I don't have a bank account, but it's not really where it needs to be. What we really need is a situation where people are just using crypto directly without even a gift card or some sort of intermediary. But that's how I've been largely doing it, is by dealing with merchants in New Hampshire that already take crypto and by using various gift cards and debit cards. And it's been a bit of it's almost like living a video game when you're trying to dodge, you know, regulators, or this company goes out of business and this happens here. And so it's like everything kind of shifts. And so now I go around the United States doing workshops. I do 4-hour workshops based on my book. The first half of the workshop is explaining to people how the threat of CBDCs and also the fact that fiat currency fail. And because most people don't have the background in what money is all about and central banking and everything else. The second part of the workshop is I actually give people a crypto wallet, give them some crypto, show them how to use the crypto to buy, to pay bills, to buy gift cards, to make transactions. I actually give them a gold back. I give them silver and discuss how they can use those things as I have for day-to-day transactions. And in the process of doing that, I've realized if we really want to be successful with this, we need to make these tools more efficient. So I'm working with some people to make a point of sale system for merchants so that it's easy for merchants to take crypto, gold, and silver so that there's an easy system for people to use to make it easier for people to do what I've been doing. Because what I've been doing, I'm willing to do because I'm willing to do it for the principle and because I know what's happening with fiat and CBDCs. But if we want it to be really successful, it shouldn't be complicated. So I'm doing everything that I can to not only educate people about the threat, but put people together to make the solution.
I go back to the beginning of the interview when I said that it just feels like there's an inevitability to all of this. And what you're telling me, what we've talked about throughout this interview, it does sound like that, that this is not really a question of fighting it anymore. It's more a question of survival and perhaps even community, as in we need to figure out how to work together, work out ways together instead of fighting it, that we just can't survive this by doing our own thing, by fighting the system.
Don't fight these systems, because when you fight a rigged system, you're putting your energy towards it and you don't get a good outcome. Just take your energy out of the system and start building these alternatives. And it is possible, but the sooner you start, the better, because this is how they get you. They get you using what are called salami tactics. They get you slice by slice. So all of a sudden, they get you with one thing. Well, I don't want to give up this convenience. How many people said, well, I'm going to take the shot, the vaccine, so that I can start to travel again? I just want the convenience of being able to do that. Or how many people said, well, I'm going to lose my job if I don't, at least this is in the US, if I don't get the vaccine. You always have a choice. People like to think that we actually live in a universe of infinite possibility. And so many people confine what is possible to what they think they know. And then they confine that to what is all that is available. But we always have a choice. But what I'm arguing is we are witnessing a controlled demolition by design of the existing financial system, the purpose of which is to usher in the great taking and to force us to take CBDCs in an emergency. This is how we get you will own nothing and be happy. The way we actually stop it is by exiting the system first before they have everything ready, so that their system basically collapses and we have an alternative. That is, at the end of the day, if I had to resolve what we actually need to do, because there's no hiding. I'm not going to say, as much as I'm in New Hampshire, there's no hiding in the woods in a cabin from these people. What the UN Agenda 2030 says, they want to regulate all assets, the land, the air, and the sea. Their model doesn't recognize national sovereignty. Even the WHO Pandemic Alliance is a step towards everything that I've been talking about. And I'll give you an example of to further cement this idea that the ultimate currency on this, tied to digital IDs and social credit, is a currency based on energy credits. Not only do you have the MasterCard tied to you, the UN, but if you look at the WHO Pandemic Alliance, that basically gives up national sovereignty to the World Health Organization. But how does the World Health Organization define health? Well, they've actually already made the leap to say that climate can be something that can be used as a health emergency. So you could see a situation where the WHO declares a climate emergency, the WHO basically takes over sovereignty, and then they push some of these systems in, and you have all of these United Nations organizations that have already signed up for this and already given away their sovereignty. That's all, like, literally it's being built. These aren't conspiracy theories. This is stuff that's actually being pushed right now. So they're building CBDCs. And we talked about the shadow groups behind the scenes that are working on this stuff, but it's the UN, the WEF, the Bank for International Settlements, the World Bank, and the IMF. Those five groups are sharing information. They have policy toolkits on CBDCs. When a country like Nigeria rolls out a CBDC, I've talked to people in Nigeria. I've talked to several people in Nigeria. And they asked me, they said, listen, why did my country do this? Only 45% of the people in Nigeria have internet access. This is not a situation where it would make logical sense to roll this out in Nigeria. And when you trace it back, it was the World Bank and the IMF that went in and basically used a combination of incentives and the stick to roll this out. And this is happening globally. So what you're happening, New Zealand's CBDC pilot is not being done in a vacuum. It is being done in a spirit of technocratic cooperation, knowing that the New Zealand CBDC is ultimately going to integrate with your assets being tokenized, and that that combined system is going to integrate with everything else that the other countries are doing in a very similar fashion.
Okay, so time's pretty much up now, but I do want to finish with something good because, you know, we did a full breakfast show on this topic last week when I was sitting in for Paul Brennan, and the feedback we got over and over and over again after that show was that this is a scary topic, and I agree that it is scary. So we also need to offer some hope as well. And there's one thing that you're doing in this space that you and your wife have started, the Daylight Freedom Foundation. Can you tell us about that to finish us off?
So we can take action, and I have been taking action. My wife and I formed a nonprofit in the United States called Daylight Freedom Foundation, and I'm also a fellow at the Brownson Institute. But the Daylight Freedom Foundation, what we're doing right now is we're doing these workshops all over the United States, and you know I'm willing to do them all over the world. I mean, I might be going to Mexico and Canada and spreading this out, and I'm teaching people in these workshops on how to exit the dollar and to start using alternatives for day-to-day transactions. This is the way out. Non-compliance is the way out. This can work. This has worked historically. Gandhi defeated the entire British Empire through radical non-compliance. And so as big and bad and scary as these people may seem to be, they assume 100% compliance. They assume that we're not going to fight back. So it only takes probably 2 or 3% of us to take steps. So when you look at the Daylight Freedom Foundation, you can see the different workshops. You can see a link to my book. You can see a link to various interviews that I've done and speaking engagements and all of that other stuff. And so this is all about taking practical steps now. So I know I come off as doom and gloom, but I come off as doom and gloom because it's legitimately a problem. But you actually can take steps. We can take steps right now. And if you like what you've heard, I'm trying to get this word out as far as I can. I will say I've been a political activist for a long time. And I used to get tons of press for doing kind of off the wall political activism in New Hampshire. And when I ran for president, which, given that it was in New Hampshire, given that I had this track record in politics, I actually reached out to 3,000 members of the press, mainstream media. And my platform was, I think, as I mentioned earlier, it's very simple. It's exit banks, exit public health, exit public schools, turn off mainstream media, and stop using big tech, right? You don't have to vote for me to do any of this, but this was essentially what my platform was. Contacted media, including media that had covered me before. Not one person in the mainstream media would pick this up, not even from the standpoint of, oh, this guy's a crackpot. And so I say that as you know, this is dangerous, these ideas to the existing power structure.
They didn't even attack you. They just ignored you.
They ignored. And I'm not going to go into some of the stuff that I've done in the past to you know, generate a lot of noise. I guess they knew enough to not bother to get me to the fight stage. But what I'm saying is, the more all the interviews that I've gotten have come organically. So, you know, any help in getting this word out, because everybody needs to know about this everywhere. I do believe CBDCs are the single biggest threat to human liberty. It is the gateway to digital tyranny. It is the gateway to digital IDs, vaccine passports, and social credit systems. And it can be stopped through non-compliance and by exiting the system immediately. And we can do that. And I can help educate people on specifically how to do that.
That's Aaron Day, entrepreneur, investor, advisor, and author, here to tell us the bigger global picture of the digital world we're marching into. And if you want to learn more and hear more from Aaron, please do visit the Daylight Freedom Foundation website at daylightfreedom.org. That's daylightfreedom.org, where you'll find an incredible amount of information on the topic of being prepared for our digital future. What Aaron has told us today is one of the points I made in my opening statement on last week's breakfast show, that what we're currently witnessing is the controlled demolition of the existing global financial system. You just need to look around to see that almost every country right now is developing a new money system called a CBDC to know that. Because why would they do it if the old money system was still working fine? And because of that, the world ahead of us, as we've just heard from Aaron, is one where there is one global platform where everybody's assets will be digitized and tied to digital IDs and digital money that can be programmed and controlled centrally. But that doesn't mean we need to take it lying down. We don't need to participate. There are other ways if we just get working together as a community now. My name is Alistair Harding, and you've been listening to Our Digital Future only on Reality Check Radio.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.